All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, Eurofolk Radio. Today is Friday, March 15th, 2024. Is this the Ides of March? Is this the day that Caesar got stabbed? I don't recall, but I think today is the Ides of March. In any case, today we're going to be talking about the Rothschilds and the power base that the Rothschilds have created in the world, and the family, of course, that nobody talks about. They don't talk much about the Rockefellers either. It's amazing. The two of the most biggest crime families, crime syndicate families, Rockefellers and Rothschilds, are never discussed in mainstream media. Of course, that's by design. You're not supposed to know about them. So forget about it, as they say. So this is from the UNS Review, and it's entitled The Richest Man in the World, and this is by Larry Romanoff. This goes back to November 21, 2022, so this is before, because Jacob Rothschild died a couple of weeks ago, as well before the death of Jacob Rothschild, but nevertheless, we see that more and more people are waking up to the criminal activities of the Rothschilds and related Jewish bankster families. So I'll just get right into it here. The author, Larry Romanoff, says, "The purpose of this essay is threefold. One, to bring to the attention of readers the existence of a long-standing conspiracy about the identification of the richest man in the world, who, of course, was Jacob Rothschild. I'm not sure who his successor is now. Two, to dismiss from contention the current list of candidates. And three, to document that a small number of Jewish banking families operating out of the city of London have for generations held these wealth records with fortunes that are orders of magnitude above anything we might have imagined, except for those of us in Christian identity. We know that they rule the world with their ability to create money. I will address these points in reverse order and deal with the current crop of wunderkind at the end." Wunderkind, that's actually in German, that is plural. And the wonder child, the wonder children of the Rothschild family. And there are many of them, but the latest batch of Rothschild children don't seem to be as ruthless and carefree. They don't care about anything, really. They don't care about us. They have no compassion, no compunction about killing us in droves by the millions. So these people don't seem to be that much interested in that kind of lifestyle anymore. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if the Rothschild dynasty begins to break up. In any case, he continues, "I do not profess to be able to irrefutably document all the assertions made in this essay, nor to definitively substantiate all the inferences made. The topic is such that too much of the necessary legal evidence is irretrievably hidden from public view and accessibility, and we must in many cases rely on logic and circumstantial evidence to support our assertions and inferences. While the proofs are not as complete as one would desire, this level of evidentiary support is often sufficient, especially when our cases follow an established pattern and we have such reasoning and evidence in bulk. The descriptions and evidence in this essay will serve at least to provide a reasonable basis for understanding and to draw attention to some of the great forces which have been molding our world." And they have been molding our world since, of course, the Battle of Waterloo, when the beast known as the fractional reserve banking system was reincarnated and the Rothschild banking dynasty took over the planet, took over the planet's wealth. And when you control the planet's money, you can control its politics and religion and just about everything else. The descriptions and evidence in this essay will serve at least to provide a reasonable basis for understanding and to draw attention to some of the great forces which have been molding our world. The figures presented in this essay are not meant as precise calculations, but to impress upon readers the magnitude of the numbers and amounts with which we are dealing. One quick announcement. The current and for the foreseeable future address of Eurofolk Radio is ANP, which stands for American National Publishing, and that's Post Office Box 3192, Harrison, Arkansas, 72601. Although the Illinois Post Office Box is still active, it will be discontinued at the end of this year. So anybody still mailing to ANP at the old Illinois address, please switch over to the new one. It's ANP, POB 3192, Harrison, Arkansas, 72601. Thank you very much. Okay, let's continue. Next heading. The power of compound interest. That's a lot of power, folks. Much of this essay is primarily dependent on only one simple thesis: that those with enormous wealth do not leave it idle, but put it to a constant good use. The money is always at work. It is lent out to finance wars and colonization, to purchase legitimate businesses, to establish control of governments and national economies, and more. Yes, much, much more. It finances all kinds of organized crime, too. As to interest rates for long-term accumulation, we tend to think of historical interest rates as being very low, perhaps only 1% or 2%, but that was seldom the case. The reason Abraham Lincoln resorted to printing his greenbacks as currency was because Rothschild demanded a 24% interest rate to fund the Union in the U.S. Civil War. There are many other such examples, as war financing in particular carried high interest rates. Dutch perpetual bonds issued by Jews were at rates of 10% to 12% in the 1500s and 1600s. Genoa issued much of its debt at 9% in the 1600s. I have used a rate of 5% for the compound interest calculations in this essay, a selection that is admittedly arbitrary, but that appears reasonable and conservative in the overall context. The accompanying charts from the Bank of England appear to justify this choice. So, let's see, they're a bit fuzzy in this online article. But anyway, you can see that because of compound interest, inflation soars dramatically. And of course, the bankers are in total control of that. Nations have no control of it whatsoever, despite what the mass media says. No, these are all private banks, all owned by Jews. Next heading, some background on corporations. A great many of the world's largest corporations are owned and controlled by Jews, many of these by the select few in the city of London, but also very many outside this small group. The world's major oil companies are controlled by Jewish interests, as are the major pharmaceutical companies, many of the weapons manufacturers and world's airlines, a preponderant amount of the world's shipping capacity, and many other industries that might not normally come to mind. So how is this possible? How are the Rothschilds able to buy up all of these corporations and businesses? Well, it's because they can create their own money and they spend it into circulation with the blessing of the governments that have created these monopolistic entities. These banks are monopolies. They monopolize the currency of the nation that they operate in. They call it a national bank as if it actually belonged to the nation, but it is in fact a private banking corporation dedicated solely to the enrichment and to the power base of the Rothschilds and other Jewish families. That's how these operations work. Control other areas of the world, including mass media, prime media outlets in the world, including movies and book publishing, These are all owned or controlled by Jews thanks to their monopolistic tendencies. There are international companies worth in total many trillions of dollars that are entirely Jewish. Nestle, Sanofi, Monsanto being a few among hundreds such. We cannot easily know what part of this reverts to our handful of Jewish bankers in the city of London, how much of that was financed by and is controlled from that center, but it isn't negligible. Things are not always what they seem. Many of the world's large fortunes were financed by Rothschild or others from that inner circle, and thus there is a hidden ownership that will never be revealed. Yeah, they're never going to reveal that hidden ownership. And all of these monopolies, whether it be railroads, oil, sometimes automobile manufacturing, etc., they always are, except in certain cases, are always involved in monopolizing the industry and putting the competition out of business. Now, that hasn't been true for automobiles. They have to keep a semblance of free enterprise appearances up for the world to follow. So that hasn't been true for automobile manufacturers as far as I can tell. But oil companies, I remember back in the 60s when I was going to college at the U of I, that I wrote a book called The Seven Sisters, and how the Seven Sisters, oil companies, who are supposedly in competition with one another, but actually fix prices so that none of them will outcompete the other. Okay. And I wasn't aware at the time that they're all owned by the Rothschilds anyway. Maybe they weren't in the 60s, but they certainly are all owned by the Rothschilds today. Okay, so let's continue. It isn't a secret, although apparently not widely known, that one of the Rothschilds financed Rockefeller's creation of Standard Oil and did the same with Andrew Carnegie's Steel Empire and the Harriman Railroad fortune in the U.S., among others. The financing was usually done through J.P. Morgan, who was a Rothschild agent for all of his career. And in fact, Morgan's banking interests themselves were much more European Jewish than they were American. It is worthy to bring this to the attention of readers, since it appears that much of the wealth of the famous American and European families may not have been really theirs, but belonged instead to the ultimate Jewish financiers in the background. Today, Google, Facebook, Tesla, Amazon, Starbucks, and many others are in this category, firms that could not possibly have attained their extent of market control without both heavy financing and intense planning originating elsewhere, and also putting other companies out of business. A number of studies have been done on interlocking corporate ownership and control, with consistent conclusions that as few as 400 companies and perhaps even as few as 250 companies own outright or at least have control of more than 40% of all the value listed on all stock exchanges everywhere. And I remember doing a show back a few years ago when I think it was the top 100 corporations listed by wealth and assets. Of all of those, only one was engaged in manufacturing. All the rest were financial corporations, whether banks, investment corporations, insurance companies, that sort of thing. That's where the money is. That's how you make money, is by making money work for you and not working for the money. Okay, that's how it works. Okay. But behind those 400 or 250 companies is that same number of men controlling those companies. Even though most large corporations are listed as public, with sometimes hundreds of millions of shares outstanding, we cannot know where the true control lies. Well, even if they are publicly traded, who's got the controlling interest? You know, if you have 51% of the shares, you control that company. Increasingly, many of the shares are held by proxies like BlackRock or Blackstone or other investment groups, and we have no information on share classifications or other restrictions on voting and control, nor do we have control of all of the derivative market, which basically lumps together all different kinds of investment, let's say a bunch of different real estate investments, which should be held individually, but aren't. They're thrown into a box, so to speak, and they're held in that box, and they're used as asset determination. So, but rather than, and then a lot of these, this is what brought the 2008 crash on. It was derivatives. There was no real asset control with derivatives. But let's continue. Nor does the general public have information on interlocking directors who have absolute day-to-day control, including over all financial decisions. More importantly, it isn't necessary to own a plurality of shares if you control the board of directors, or if they are reading from the same script. These people can empty a company's treasury to pay unlimited dividends tax-free through a tax haven, and do so without even attracting unrest from the common shareholders, who seldom have much understanding of these matters. Okay? Yeah, Wall Street and all these stock exchanges are nothing but Jew gambling houses. And anybody who invests in those are risking everything they have. Many European banks fall into this category, most of these Jewish-owned and tightly held. The few dozens of Europe's largest banks like HSBC, BNP, Paribas, Lloyds have a market cap in the trillions and an asset base of over 30, I guess it's a euro, a C with a couple of lines drawn through it. I guess it's supposed to be an E. It looks like a C with a couple of horizontal lines, or of over 30 trillion euros, I'm assuming. And now it's interesting because I'm a tennis fan. I've been watching some of the tennis at the Paribas Open in Indian Wells, California. And the stands are virtually empty for most of these games. They usually start to fill up when the finals approach, quarterfinals and finals. And then the stands start to fill up. But with trillions of dollars by Paribas, I can see why it's not a concern. Okay. But they can invest in something like this and make it a going tennis tournament. Maybe even compete with the four big tournaments every year, et cetera, et cetera. All right. The major North American banks like Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, again owned by Jews, have a market cap of well over 1.5 trillion in assets to match. Plus, we have literally hundreds of Jewish-owned banks in Switzerland and other countries that appear on no list anywhere. Many of the world's largest insurance and reinsurance companies are owned by Jews with a combined market cap in the trillions, and there is no way to place a value on Lloyd's of London, a worldwide insurance platform that is virtually priceless. Then there are the oil companies. Royal Dutch Shell alone has a market cap of over 200 billion, and there are many of these Jewish-controlled sufficient to control the world price of oil, as we will see. The two major FMCG companies, don't know what that stands for, FMCG, Unilever and P&G, Procter & Gamble, I guess those are, well, they're involved in pharmaceuticals, but probably many other types of products as well. Unilever and P&G, which I believe stands for Procter & Gamble, both Jewish, have a combined market cap of over $500 billion. Internet-related firms like Google, Meta, Amazon, Dell, Oracle, again all Jewish, have combined market cap of nearly $5 trillion. The world's fashion houses and jewelry firms, mostly Jewish-owned or controlled, firms like Swarovski, YSL, LVMH, Cartier, Hermes, Estee Lauder, L'Oreal have a market cap of more than $1 trillion, and there are hundreds of jewelry firms, diamond cutters, and merchants, gold dealers operating behind the scenes that are also owned by Jews and worth a combined trillions of dollars. So you can see with all of this monopolization of industry and capital, it's easy. Once you control half the world's market, the other half is easy pickings. The major armaments and weapons manufacturers, which have always had a high percentage of Jewish ownership and control, Again, the Nobel Peace Prize. Nobel was I believe he invented either TNT or dynamite, one or the other. So he was a warmonger. They have a market cap in the vicinity of $1 trillion. The world's major food companies, again mostly owned by Jews, is another example. Nestle, an entirely Jewish company, owns more than 2,000 food brands with a market cap of about one-third of $1 trillion by itself. PepsiCo is the second largest food company in the world, owning hundreds of major brands, and many others like Kraft Heinz, I guess Kraft Heinz is now one company, Mondelez, Danone, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, Anheuser-Busch in bed with Bud Light, Coca-Cola, Diageo, Starbucks have a combined market cap of at least $1.5 trillion. The world's largest pharmaceutical companies are all Jewish-controlled or owned, with a combined market cap of around $4 trillion. And the pharmaceutical companies, along with the vaccine manufacturers, are the biggest killers on the planet. They kill more people by medicine than any other means of death. They have made a covenant with death. Okay, so this is quite an extensive article. I'm certainly not going to be able to finish it today. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue with this, but I'll definitely make it available because this is really a good summary of Jewish behind the scenes power. You rarely get articles like this. This is an outstanding article. Now let's continue. The main North American media companies, all owned by Jews, have a market cap of over $1 trillion, with larger numbers for the European media that are also largely Jewish-owned and virtually all Jewish-controlled. And this ignores their media holdings in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. And there are literally hundreds of Jewish-owned companies that don't fit easily into the above categories, including everything from H&R Block to Mattel and Hasbro, Monsanto, Ben & Jerry's. The list is almost endless. Collectively, their value and influence are enormous. Oh, for sure. The corporations control the world, especially the banking corporations. The real power. Family dynasties. When we read of a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, Warren Buffett, I don't believe, is Jewish. We tend to think in simple terms of someone starting a company with a good idea and over a lifetime building a huge enterprise that today is worth many billions. But this reasoning is simplistic because we are confining our thought to only one generation. The people with whom we are concerned here are family dynasties that have been accumulating their fortunes for perhaps 10 or even 20 generations, not years, generations. With the Rothschilds, Sassoons, and so many others, we are going back to the 1600s and 1700s. And the Sassoons, of course, although putatively in the perfume business, have been in the opium business from the beginning. And they're the ones who caused the opium wars in China and India. All right, with family dynasties that have expanded enormously over the centuries and maintained control over their increasingly vast wealth through avoidance of inheritance taxes, rigid intermarriage, and shared intentions. The greatest of all family dynasties are hidden from view, expunged from the media, deleted from the history books, and almost never attract public attention. All of these are Jewish. Rothschild, Sassoon, Sebag Montefiore, that's Sebag - Montefiore, Warburg, Lehman, Goldman, and so many names you may have never heard of. Here's a listing of a few of the Jewish bankers, representing perhaps only 25% of them, most of them having begun banking, financing, and industrial operations in the early to mid-1800s, so an average of nearly 200 years, and many resulting in Jewish family dynasties that continue to this day entirely out of the public eye. Rothschild, Sassoon, Warburg, Moses Montefiore, Sebag Montefiore, Kaduri, Lehman, Israel Moses Seif, Kuhn Loeb, Goldman Sachs, Salomon, Giff, Joseph Hambro, J. Henry Schroeder, Samuel Montague, Emile and Isaac Perrier, Lazard Brothers, Speyer Brothers, Seligman Brothers, Stern Brothers, Barnato Brothers, Ernest Oppenheimer, Abraham Oppenheim, Carl Furstenberg, Jacob Goldschmidt, Oscar Wasserman, Hirsch, Raphael Jonathan Bischofsheim, Hambro, Isaac Glückstadt, Levy Martin, Marcus Rubin, Goldschmidt with a D, Rosenthal, A. Dunkelsbühler, Eugene Gutmann, Herbert Gutmann, Wag and Company, Medici Family, Speyer, Speyer Ellison, Emil Erlanger, S. Japhet, Ernest Castle, Carl Meyer, Achille Fold, Luigi Luzzatti, Wertheimer, and Gompertz Lippmann. So, quite a list of Jewish companies, and they control the publication of Bibles these days as well, so you're not going to get a decent Bible anymore. I have a graphic on my computer that displays the holdings of the Rothschild dynasty, displayed rather like an organization chart, with small boxes indicating holdings and lines everywhere indicating ownership and control. It is so large that to print it in the smallest readable type would require a sheet of paper half a meter in size. Rothschild recently created a new bank just to manage his land holdings confiscated from poor countries. Yeah, the banking is really good for poor countries. It is difficult to obtain hard information because so much of this is done through no-name banks, agents, related companies, and run through innumerable tax havens. Rothschild owns, among other things, Sanofi Pharma, with a capitalization of $125 billion. The Economist, and IHS, which is the largest mobile tower operator in Africa. Anglo-American was founded by Ernest Oppenheimer, a German Jew. Headquartered in the city of London, this is one of the 250 largest companies in the world, producing gold, diamonds, other metals, and nearly half of all the world's platinum. Their subsidiaries and investments are too many to list. When Ernest died, he was succeeded by his son Harry, who also became chairman of De Beers, so you can see how the families integrate and rationalize their holdings. Yeah, well, diamonds and gold. Naturally, you want to put those two together, right? The Jewish Wallenbergs in Sweden, and Brother Michael Swede has mentioned the Wallenbergs at numerous occasions on our shows, on Bloodlines. The Jewish Wallenbergs in Sweden have been in business for 200 years, where today they own most large Swedish industrial groups like Enskilda Bank, Ericsson, Electrolux, ABB, Saab, SAS Group, SKF, Atlas Copco, and NASDAQ. As far back as 50 years ago, the Wallenberg family businesses employed 40% of Sweden's industrial workforce and represented 40% of the total worth of the Stockholm stock market. The market capitalization of only 10 of their companies is nearly $350 billion, and much has been buried in trust and hidden in tax havens. Swarovski, with their fake crystal, is another 150-year-old Jewish dynasty. For this essay, I will ignore much of the past history of these Jewish families and begin from the early 1800s. But it should be noted that these Khazar family fortunes began hundreds of years before this. We had the Jewish-Dutch tulip bubble, the Jewish South Seas bubble, the Jewish, British, and Dutch East India companies, and many similar. There were the centuries of slave trading, of tax farming, and so much more. I will omit all of that. India was at one time almost certainly the richest nation in the world, with stocks of gold, silver, and precious gems worthy of fable and legend. The British East India Company, which was eventually led by one of the Rothschilds, was unquestionably the greatest criminal enterprise in the history of the world. That's correct. And before that was the Dutch East India Corporation, and the vehicle used to loot India to the bones. Sassoon bin Salih was the chief treasurer of the Pashas of Baghdad. exposed in an immense fraud in the early 1800s that must have involved hundreds of billions in today's dollars, he was lucky to escape with his life and the money. He and his two sons, David and Joseph, fled to India, where they teamed up with one of the Rothschilds and hatched their infernal plan to force Indian peasants to grow opium for sale in China. From the early days, they already had the young Queen Victoria firmly in their grasp, with Benjamin Disraeli being her Jewish prime minister. She not only supported their efforts to the extent of allocating the British military as the Jews enforcers of the opium, giving David Sassoon the exclusive franchise for selling opium in all of China, seizing Hong Kong for his distribution base, and giving him the charter to form the HSBC. I was very annoyed to find out that Menards is owned by HSBC. To say that the British royal family profited heavily from this personally would be an understatement of some magnitude. This is where we will begin our story. Folks, it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Seven of None says, I believe it was the Wallenbergs who, after World War II, bought up German factories for literally pennies. That's quite possible. But I also know that American company, the paint manufacturing company, I can't think of their name. They might not have been Jewish at the time during World War II, but they owned IG Farben, which was the German branch of the American company, and American airmen were told not to bomb IG Farben because it was actually owned by an American, probably American Jewish corporation. And this is how they keep making money, because they don't suffer from war. Everybody else does. Okay. Back to the richest man in the world. Okay. The Sassoons were really big in those days. Ledger entry, Rothschild, $40 trillion in today's dollars. Ledger entry, Sassoon, $40 trillion in today's dollars. Item number one, slavery and forced labor. And if you've been following the shows that Ted Midward and I have been doing about the Civil War, we know, and he quoted the Jewish publication in London, which said, if we don't get rid of this greenback, then America will become the richest nations on the face of the earth. We have to prevent America. That's why we have to get rid of the greenback. Slavery and forced labor. Jews have always been heavily involved in slave trading, including both the white slaves that depopulated Ireland and much of England and the more recent black slaves. But I will ignore that part of the past and deal only with the more recent events in China. Slave trading by these same richest Jews, Rothschild, Sassoon, Kaduri, and many others, stopped only because the First World War put an end to it. We haven't precise numbers, but the historical record tells us that many millions of Chinese were kidnapped and sold as slave labor. Countless tens of thousands of Chinese were kidnapped and shipped as slave labor to North America to build the railroads and work the gold mines, to build the Panama Railway and the Panama Canal, to work the guano mines in Peru, and in many other instances. This is why we have Chinese all over the world. Even today, the population of Panama is more than 10% Chinese because of this. In many cases, the Chinese were not actually sold to others, but used by the Jews as slave labor for their own project. As late as 1904, Rothschild had around 65,000 Chinese kidnapped from Fujian province to work his gold mines in South Africa. Oh, that's why there's so many Chinamen in South Africa. When these same Jews financed the building of the North American Railroad and the Panama Canal, for example, kidnapped Chinese were the supply of free and disposable labor. And of course, the white railroad engineers and owners are the ones to blame, right? Harsh conditions resulting in tens of thousands of deaths were irrelevant because the supply was inexhaustible. As well, there is credible evidence that Easter Island was almost totally depopulated by these same Jews who kidnapped most of the people to work the guano mines in Peru. There are letters from officials in the UK demanding that these Jews return the Easter Islanders to their home, okay? Gee, I better watch out. I don't want to be kidnapped. At this distance in time, it isn't possible to construct a comprehensive tally of the totals of Chinese slave laborers conscripted by these Jews for their project, nor to estimate the value of all this slave labor. But it was certainly substantial and carried on in a great volume from about 1800 to 1920. And as I mentioned above, it was only the First World War that put a stop to it. I list this because it is an important contributing aspect to the accumulated wealth of these Jewish banking families, but I do not provide a ledger entry for it. Okay, well, it's impossible to estimate the wealth accumulated by Jews over slavery. But actually, as part of before the Civil War, the British Jews divested themselves of all their slave holdings in preparation for the Civil War, because they knew they couldn't be posturing or making war against America or the South, if they so chose, by holding slaves themselves. So they had to divest themselves of their slaves, but they paid themselves handsomely for that. So that was, I believe, done in the 1830s and 40s. And so no Brits owned slaves in America from that point forward, no black slaves. Now we're here talking here about Chinamen and others. So they only divested themselves of black slaves. Okay. Number two, diamonds. It's not a secret that De Beers controlled the diamond production of South Africa and also in Zaire, nor that De Beers is a Rothschild company. Let's not forget the origin and purpose of the Boer Wars. Diamond production statistics seem scattered, with South Africa claiming around 650 million carats of total production, while a statistic claims twice this amount. South Africa places a value on this production at $100 per carat, at about 60 billion. But with no allowance for the compounding an average of 300 million per year over 150 years, average of 3 million carats per year as at $100 per carat. If we allow for compounding at 5%, this accumulates to about 10 trillion. To keep things simple, I have excluded all other countries from this calculation. The addition of these and other Rothschild and Jewish-owned productions would at least double the total. It should also be noted that the Jewish enclave of Holland is still the center of the world diamond trade, the great majority of which is firmly in Jewish hands. Ledger entry, 10 trillion in today's dollars. Three, gold. It is difficult to find comprehensive and reliable statistics on the actual annual production of gold from the Rothschild-controlled mines, but production apparently reached more than 1,000 tons per year 50 years ago. With 32,000 ounces in a ton of gold and gold selling at $1,700 an ounce, it's higher this year, this is from 2021, that represents many billions of dollars per year, compounded at 5% for nearly 150 years, about 10 times the value of the diamond production listed above. The picture is clouded by fluctuations in both production amounts and gold prices, so definitive results are impossible to calculate. I have assumed what I believe is a conservative estimate of only twice the diamond production and value, ledger entry, $20 trillion in today's dollars. But even here, when the price of gold fluctuates, the Rothschilds and other Jewish gold traders always manage to use the gold to buy other precious metals, okay? So that should the gold go down, those other precious metals will stay up in value and they'll be able to buy back the gold at a profit. So they're always, and they probably create a lot of this fluctuation in market value themselves. Number four, canals, Panama and the Suez. It is universally known that the U.S. built Panama, that the U.S. built the Panama Canal after, quote, liberating the province of Panama from Colombia, but not so widely known that it was Jewish money that paid for the canal. We can reasonably assume that the profits from the canal for about 120 years would have accrued to those who financed it. The Suez Canal was also built with Jewish money and existed as a privately held corporation. However, since the revenues from these two amount to only a few mere billions of dollars per year, I will omit them from the totals. Ledger entry, zero trillions. Okay, it doesn't add up to any trillions. Five, cash management. It isn't widely known, but as part of America's Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. used not only its powerful bullying diplomacy, but also the CIA and the full force of its military to arrange for a few Jewish bankers and the U.S. Fed to obtain the position of investment managers of all the cash assets and central bank holdings of the countries under its control. This included Latin America, but also countries like the Philippines and the 50-plus countries where the U.S. overthrew a government and installed a compliant dictatorship. Yeah, and I think the Spanish-American War, you could say exactly the same thing about that. The scheme was simple. These nations were forced to turn over all their liquid assets to the Jewish bankers in the U.S., who would prudently manage all that cash for the benefit of these smaller nations. In practice, the Jewish bankers invested the money in New York real estate and profited in the billions while paying those nations 3% on their money. This practice was coupled with a bad American habit of invading, then forcing open and emptying the vaults of the central banks of these same nations of all their gold. These practices are sufficiently documented to withstand challenge, and having existed for about 150 years, I think we could reasonably attach a total compounded to today of at least $1 trillion. But the historical records are insufficient, and so I make no ledger entry for this item. Now, this one should be interesting. Germany's hyperinflation. Oh, man, Hitler was right. Hitler was definitely right, ladies and gentlemen. Germany's hyperinflation. It is widely accepted today that Germany was set up for this precise circumstance from the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. Absolutely. The Treaty of Versailles was designed to destroy Germany and the corresponding restrictions enacted by Jews to prevent Germany's recovery. Regardless, and according to Douglas Reed, who did tremendous research on the Treaty of Versailles, he concluded that every party that that went with Wilson to the Versailles Peace Conference was Jewish. They either, even if Wilson himself wasn't Jewish, he had his left-hand man, Colonel House, directing the affairs for him. So it was really House who directed the affairs at the Versailles Treaty, not Woodrow Wilson. And pretty much Woodrow Wilson's 14 points were totally ignored by those people. And then on top of it, if even to make matters worse, since all of the committees, the delegations that were sent to the Versailles Treaty had Jews or were run by Jews, the Zionists had their own delegation to the Treaty of Versailles. Imagine that. And they weren't even a country yet. Regardless, the inflation rate was so extreme that money became literally worthless, permitting the Jewish bankers to buy up much of Germany for virtually nothing. This was one of the deep resentments harbored by Hitler toward the Jews. Knowing they were behind the treaty and other restrictions that could have had only the bankruptcy and subjugation of Germany as the one possible purpose, and also including the attempt to turn it into a communist country by Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. We needn't go into details here, but it was Hitler's eviction of the Jews from Germany's banking system and taking over the country's central bank that resulted in the miracle of Germany's economic recovery, which unfortunately was not to last. There is no way to estimate the value of the looting of Germany that took place at this time, And I attribute no definitive value to it, although the present value would surely be in the many trillions of dollars, all to the benefit of these same few banksters. So I would say 50 trillion at least. Number 7, central banks. European Jewish banking families led by the Rothschilds own or control the central banks of at least 30 nations, including the Fed and the U.S. There are several very nasty results of this ownership, one of which is that these nations cannot print their own money, but must borrow it from the privately owned central banks and pay interest on it. This is of enormous magnitude. Until the late 1970s, Canada owned its own central bank and paid little to no interest to foreigners. But then Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau is not Justin's father. He is the son of his wife, or his mother, that is Pierre Trudeau's wife. And who's the commie who controlled Cuba? Fidel Castro. He is the son of Fidel Castro and Mrs. Trudeau. The result is that in the past 30 or 40 years, little Canada has paid these bankers more than $1.1 trillion in interest for borrowing its own money. You might especially want to watch item 22, a video of Canada's former cabinet minister commenting on banking in America. There's several links here. I guess link number 22 is that video. But Rothschild and a handful of other Jewish banking families have owned the central banks of the European nations and others, including the U.S. Fed, for well over 100 years. If little Canada has paid more than $1 trillion in interest in a relatively short time, the governments of countries like England, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Japan, South Africa have paid much more during the past century. As one example, Italy's debt is several times that of Canada, and many other countries are in the same position. I have no accurate record of total interest the U.S. has paid to the Fed, but its current debt is more than $13 trillion, an amount which will never be paid off. So we're going to have another war. Working from Canada as a baseline and counting only 30 countries, an excessively conservative estimate would be $30 trillion paid out in interest to these bankers. If we then allow for only 100 years, we can multiply this by more than three times and arrive at around $100 trillion paid in interest, entirely without need or justification. And this doesn't allow for the U.S. Fed, which would increase the total by half again. It should be also noted that those 50-plus nations where the U.S. military and CIA overthrew a government, the Jewish bankers were right behind them to take over ownership of all those central banks. In every case where information has escaped, Iraq, Libya, you remember what they did to Gaddafi, right? Iraq, Libya, South Africa, and the Balkans, this has been their priority, and simple logic dictates that it would be very high on their list in every country where they had access. I have not included this item in my estimates. Considering all of the above, my ledger entry is arguably conservative by 75% or more. But there is insufficient detail. My estimate below makes no allowance for the compounding of interest or even 100 years. To do so would multiply the total a truly astronomical figure. And yet the real world situation is that this amount would indeed be compounded and for more than 100 years to the many hundreds of trillions. Okay, so he estimates 100 trillion. Number 8. So we only have about 10 minutes left, so let me scroll down. This is recessions and depressions. We have talked about that on numerous occasions, how the Jews control the economy and make or break economies and cause crashes and cause boom and bust periods. They're really good at that. Once you control, if you control, as Amschel Rothschild said, give me the power to issue a nation's currency, and I care not who makes it laws. It is so simple. However, you have to assassinate a lot of political leaders and bribe and politicians and break people's legs to prevent them from talking, that kind of thing, because this is a mafia, folks. This is a banking mafia. I'm just going to scroll down to the next paragraph under booms and busts here. In the 1929 Great Depression was one such, with euphoria based on the Jewish owners of the Fed expanding an almost unlimited money supply and easy credit with low interest rates, building a huge bubble which was then burst. Thousands of banks, tens of thousands of companies, and millions of families, including farmers, all went bankrupt, with all those assets mostly flowing eventually to the Jewish owners of the U.S. Fed and their closest friends. This was done many times prior to 1929 and has been done many times since. The bitterly savage recession in 1983 was similarly created by the U.S. Fed on orders from the City of London, with Volcker even boasting openly about what he was doing. The 2008 housing and financial crisis in the U.S. was identical and in no way accidental. It was so bad that an executive of Goldman Sachs said at the time, quote, "Things will never return to normal after what they have done," unquote. Who, the Rothschilds, the Jews? The collapsing of the industrial economies in 2022 is the same. A sudden and deliberately contrived energy shortage, created in large part by the sabotage of Nord Stream 2, and don't forget, COVID, a reduction in the money supply, and the stiff raising of interest rates, quote, to, quote, combat inflation, unquote, which was entirely self-induced, and soon blood will once again be running in the streets, and an almost unlimited number of industrial corporations, especially in Germany, but also in the weaker European nations, will be facing bankruptcy and takeovers, the news of which will never reach the public thanks to the almost total media control by these same people. So we've covered booms and busts by bankers numerous times, so let's continue. Looting the oil industry in 1983, that looks interesting. As a detailed example, let's look at the Fed-induced 1983 recession and its effect on only the oil industry in North America. To begin, let's assume we have an oil well with a constant steady production, which many are, but in this case of only one barrel per year for 40 years, with the oil price at around $100 per barrel. That gives us a total value of $4,000. However, since $1 next year is worth less than $1 this year, we discount our future production at some interest rate with this result in terms of value if we want to sell our oil well. Or oil well. 0%, $4,000. 3%, $2,500. 6%, $1,500. 10%, $1,000. 25%, $400. So they're discounting their future production. Let's see what this means. Immediately prior to the 1983 recession, the New York Times proclaimed that a sudden and inexplicable oil glut had arrived, such that oil became nearly worthless. Actually, we have a never-ending oil glut. The idea that oil is going to run out is just a fictitious idea promoted by the oil industry. Such that oil became nearly worthless, prices dropping from U.S. $40 to less than $10 almost overnight. Of course, if the price of oil drops by 75%, the value of our oil well drops by 75% as well. So our 4,000 oil well is now worth only 1,000. But we had a double whammy because the Fed wasn't idle during this period. After causing a massive burst of inflation in the 1970s, to prepare for this eventual result, the Fed suddenly felt a need to fight inflation by driving interest rates up to 20% and even 25%. The result was that oil wells were then selling at a discount of 25% on cash flow. And I know because at the time I was in the oil business and was buying and selling oil properties, some quite large, at this discount rate. This means that our $4,000 oil well, which is now worth only $1,000 due to collapse in the price of oil, was then hit with the Fed's interest rate sting and was now worth only $100. And with the blood running in the streets, this was when our Jewish Khazar banksters in the City of London sent in their agents to buy low, sell high. Okay, with about 4 minutes left, let's see what other. Oh, looting Americans, 1975 to 2022. Let's see what this is. Item number 10. The situation is not different in the 2008 financial meltdown in the U.S. We had clearly deliberate attempts to inflate the housing market to almost atmospheric levels, with nearly zero interest rates and the removal of all restrictions and requirements, and bringing in penniless Mexicans to buy brand new homes, which were financed by banks at very low rates of interest, to the point where unemployed homeless people were buying $500,000 homes. Oh, man, I didn't get a chance to do that. This was again done with the full cooperation of the Fed. Then they simply collapsed the bubble, resulting in tens of millions of foreclosures. And again, when the blood was running in the streets, firms like BlackRock and their ilk were busy buying up these foreclosed homes at perhaps half the price. There is no accurate record of the total purchases because it's all hidden, folks, right? At one point, one agent in Florida for one investment firm alone was bidding more than 200 homes per week. With even conservative estimates, the transfer of housing assets alone from the American middle class to these same few people would have been $7 or $8 trillion, all within 2 or 3 years. And I know several, because I was still working in Chicago at that time, and several of my customers, wealthy customers, had invested in the stock market, and many of them told me they lost half of their wealth during this bubble period. So, folks, this is what happens when Jews run your country, but they run virtually every country, and the countries they don't run are probably not worth running by them. So it's going to continue this way until Yahweh decides it's over. Now, it's very interesting, just as a quick point. During 2024, we're going to be experiencing Yahweh's 70th Jubilee from the date when the Israelites invaded Canaan land under Joshua. That's the Grand Jubilee, 70 Jubilees. And this number 70 means judgment. So whether the Jews think they're going to control the economy in 2024 and 25, I think Yahweh has other ideas. Whatever they plan to collapse is going to be far worse than they realize. It's going to be a, what do you call it? What's the term for a nuclear explosion, right? It's going to be a nuclear explosion. He uses the term meltdown here. But it's going to be a meltdown of uncontrolled disaster. A meltdown of uncontrolled disaster that ultimately these people have to be judged. Yahweh is going to judge them. But we better be ready to exist on barter for a while. So stock up on your goods because it's going to get really bad. So anyway, that's tonight's show. This wonderful article really detailing Jewish wealth and power in the world. From the UNS Review, The Richest Man in the World by Larry Romanoff, dated November 21st, 2022. I will upload this article along with the uploading of tonight's show. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, pass the ammunition. Talk to you all later. Bye-bye.